Negotiators from Europe and the U.S. are meeting in Washington, trying again to reach a free trade agreement. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, would create the world's biggest free trade zone, but there is a problem here. Europeans are worried about American products, including American chicken. Susanna Capilouto reports.
Mutter Schimpf doesn't want to eat American chicken.
In Europe, there's definitely a disgust about chlorinated chicken.
Schimpf is with the group Friends of the Earth Europe. Chlorinated chicken is what she calls U.S. poultry, and she doesn't want it in Europe, where chlorine was banned in the 90s, out of fear that it could cause cancer. U.S. poultry is chilled in antimicrobial baths that can include chlorine to keep salmonella and other bacteria in check. Europeans now worry the TTIP treaty could bring them U.S. chicken. On the German equivalent of the Daily Show, it is called the Heute Show, U.S. poultry has become a running joke. In this skit, a reporter is in the White House kitchen eating a chicken nugget. He jokes, you can't be mad at someone who makes such a tasty chlorinated chicken. It has a slight aroma of kiddie pool, he quips.
Most of those concerns about, you know, chemical use and those kinds of things are blown up in the media to become a problem that really doesn't exist.
Scott Russell teaches poultry science at the University of Georgia. He says U.S. processors use about a capful of chlorine per gallon or 50 parts per million in a water tank that chills the chicken carcass. And that chlorine, he says, keeps chicken safe, gets washed off, and is no harm to consumers. Europeans, he says, use a different approach.
In Europe, their efforts at controlling foodborne illnesses is all in the live bird. For example, the grandparent stock, the breeder stock, all of those flocks of chickens are tested regularly for salmonella. If they're positive, they remove them, all of them.
And with this method, Europeans have reduced salmonella in their chicken to just 2%, says Russell, but it took nearly 20 years to get there. Europeans have pushed for some of the toughest food safety standards in the world. They want to eat fresh chicken that's air-chilled rather than dumped in chlorine water tanks, says Kes Vermeeren with the Association of the European Poultry Industry. We spoke via Skype.
The main principle of the food policy in the European Union is the so-called farm-to-fork approach. And you may say that's a bit fundamentally different in what's happening outside Europe in many places.
That strict food policy makes poultry production more expensive. A study by Wageningen University in the Netherlands shows it takes about a dollar in Europe to produce a pound of chicken. The U.S. can do it for less than 80 cents. James Sumner is president of the U.S. Poultry Export Council. He says over 120 countries accept the U.S. processing method. It's cheaper, and Europe, he says, doesn't want U.S. competition.
If the truth were to be known, that's the real reason they don't want us there, and chlorine is a convenient excuse.
For activists like Mutter Schimpf, who are trying to sway the public to reject a big treaty that's full of legal jargon and complicated regulations, the chicken argument works.
So to simplify it, in Europe, very often the chlorinated chicken is used as a symbol to describe what European consumers and citizens don't want to have as an outcome from the trade talks.
Besides changes in chicken production, activists are also fighting the possibility of hormone-treated beef and genetically engineered crops on the European market should TTIP succeed. The talks between the U.S. and the EU are held in secret, but any agreement needs the nod of the European Parliament, which is elected by a public that worries a lot about its food supply. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capilouto in Atlanta.
In New Orleans, they are called snowballs. Not snow cones, not slushies, snowballs. And in New Orleans, they are serious business. Legal battles have even been waged over snowball recipes. No snowball stand is more iconic than the one Ernest and Mary Hansen opened 75 summers ago, Hansen's Snow Blizz. And when Hansen's closes for the season this week, summer in New Orleans is truly over. Keith O'Brien sent this story.
Ashley Hansen begins her days making syrup.
So first we put the water in.
Next, she slices open a 25-pound bag of sugar. That goes in the water. Then she stirs it up with the same metal spoon her grandparents, Ernest and Mary, used for so long, the spoon went flat on one side.
And that's from 75 years of stirring sugar and water together.
The syrup makes the snowball sweet. but it's Ernest's machine, built in 1939, that shaves the ice into powdery white snow. There's no crunch to a New Orleans snowball, especially at Hanson's. The ice is like wisps of cotton candy, only cold and award-winning. This year, the James Beard Foundation dubbed Hanson's an American classic, the food equivalent of an Academy Award. It's no wonder people like Chad Gautreau will drive past a dozen other snowball stands just to get to Hanson's.
You just can't beat it here. The ice is different, everything's different, and they put a little bit of love in everyone. You can taste it.
Ernest and Mary died within 6 months of each other after Hurricane Katrina 9 years ago. But Ashley has been working at Hanson's for 25 years. She's refused to let go of her grandparents' cinder block stand with its hand-scrawled menu, wood-paneled walls, and devoted customers.
I've seen a lot of people grow up. It's just remarkable because I'm sure this is how my grandparents felt when they would see their customers grow up and go off to college and come back with their own families. I mean, we're multi-generational now at 75 years.
They're also busy. Every day from March to October, Ashley and her staff make 30 gallons of syrup. Every week, they serve nearly a ton of ice. And as another summer ends, there's Ashley selling the last snowballs of the season.
I'm going to go with the $4 size, and then I'm going to go with the Bananas Foster.
You want the bananas? Awesome.
Everyone has a personal preference.
Peach, pineapple, and strawberry.
Oh, the classic is half nectar cream, half ice cream cream. I can't ever get anything else.
My favorite flavor is blue bubblegum.
What about yours?
Rainbow. It has all the flavors in it except coffee.
Of course, coffee's a flavor too, and let's be honest, snowballs can be meals.
This is my lunch break.
Monica Riggs drove an hour recently for her last snowball.
My husband thinks I'm nuts, but he doesn't understand. This is my childhood. This is nostalgia for me. It's more than just a snowball.
It's personal, it's history, a gathering spot. Every town has one. A place to remember and be remembered, to be with family and also total strangers, and be happy, even when waiting in long lines. David Kimberly comes to Hanson's every day.
No matter how long the line is or how many people are waiting, they'll take the time to ask how you're doing, how your family is. It's a great place. It reflects the whole philosophy of New Orleans.
That life is for living, treats are worth having, and they're most delicious when shared with others. It makes the last day of the season bittersweet for Ashley Hanson, the woman serving up those treats.
It's the end of the summer. Everyone's back in school. Fall will be right around the corner. Pumpkin pies and Halloween candy and snowballs become unwanted.
But not really. It's just time to say goodbye to her customers for now.
Have a nice winter. See you in the spring.
By then, the kids will be a little taller, their parents a little older. Some people will be gone. But Hanson's will still be here with Ashley behind the counter. It's about 150 days until the snowball stand opens again. For NPR News, I'm Keith O'Brien in New Orleans.
And now this, it's a story of millennials, people born after 1980 who came of age in this century.
Many millennials and near millennials have embraced vintage items.
You know, vinyl records.
Thick framed glasses.
And now dietary laws.
My name is Lisa Falds. I'm 21 years old. And yes, I do keep kosher.
She keeps kosher. According to a 2013 Pew Research Center study, about 1/4 of millennial Jews are keeping kosher.
That's almost twice the rate of their baby boomer parents, so this is not necessarily because of their parents' influence.
Now, that millennial we just heard, Lisa Falds, says she ate whatever she wanted growing up.
Bacon, ham, all that fun stuff, seafood, shellfish.
She dropped all that a few months ago. Another millennial, Margot Smith, says it's about values.
Taking the root idea of keeping kosher as an idea of being respectful and knowledgeable about the way in which your food is prepared and where it comes from, and kind of combining it with the farm-to-table philosophy.
The Atlantic magazine is all over this story, saying millennial kosher-keeping Jews are having a big influence on kosher cuisine. There's now kosher grass-fed beef and kosher free-range chicken, organic, of course. In uber-hip Brooklyn, a restaurant serves kosher banh mi. That's a Vietnamese sandwich, in case you were wondering.
And then there's the Gefilteria, a New York company offering small-batch, high-end versions of Bubby's classic gefilte fish.
Mm.
Call it kosher cool. This is NPR News. You know this scene, at least I do. It's been a long day at work. You're late to pick up your kids, and you have exactly 1 hour to make dinner before your family starts a revolution. You need help getting something delicious on the table in short order. New York Times food columnist and food writer Mark Bittman is here to help. His latest cookbook is called How to Cook Everything Fast. Mark Bittman joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
So you've got several books in the How to Cook Everything series. These are bold claims you make. Everything? Really? Everything?
Well, the everything part is, it's the marketers. What can I say? And, you know, How to Cook Everything has always been simple, and it's always been basic, and I like to think it's always been smart, but it wasn't necessarily fast, and that's what people really want. So the goal is that you walk in the kitchen, you open the page to the recipe you want, assuming you have the ingredients, you just start. You turn on the oven, you put a pan on the stove, you start some water boiling, whatever it is. You don't do this outmoded thing that the French call mise en place, this outmoded system of pulling out all your ingredients at once and preparing them and then starting to cook.
These aren't just recipes. You're giving step-by-step instructions. While you're making this, you should prep this.
Exactly. And it's timed so that each step has a preparation angle, a preparation portion, and a cooking portion, but they're timed so that each one segues perfectly naturally into the other.
So I tried my hand at a couple of these recipes.
I'm really glad to hear that.
I made the stir-fried curried chickpeas with potatoes and carrots.
Nice recipe.
It was delicious. And the fastest chicken parm. So I wanted to talk about both of these. I did the chickpeas with potatoes and carrots, honestly, because I happen to have a can of coconut milk way
back
in my pantry.
As good a reason as any.
And I needed a reason to use it. And I have to say it was good. It was pretty fast. I'm not sure that can of coconut milk wasn't expired, but you can't help me with that.
You can't lay that on me, no.
But I have to say the chicken parm was not so fast for me.
How long did it take you?
Well, it took me about 45 minutes, but I think that's because the chicken breast that I used may not have been thin enough.
You cut them in half?
No, I just pounded them to make them thinner.
Well, you have to read the instructions. Oh. I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. You can't say
so
it took longer than
there's no room for improvisation.
Well, let me walk you through the recipe, and we won't criticize your fact that you've ignored the recipe entirely.
Okay.
But
okay.
I think this is my favorite recipe in the book, and it should be 30 minutes. You turn the broiler on. You slice the chicken breasts in half horizontally so they will cook faster, and then you pound them a little bit on top of that.
Yeah.
So they should be half an inch thick at the most at that point.
Yeah.
And then you put the chicken cutlets on this already heated baking sheet and top with these tomatoes that you sliced when you were slicing the chicken breasts. And you just broil on one side, and that should take only 10 minutes or less. And then while that's happening, you grate cheese, mozzarella, and Parmesan, and you get some basil ready, and you make a mix of breadcrumbs and the cheeses. And when the chicken's done, you put all that stuff on top and put it back in the broiler. I've made this 3 or 4 times, and I think it's just an incredible recipe. And it's not only faster than making a tomato sauce and baking the chicken and coating it in breadcrumbs and all of that. I think it's better. It's really got a wonderful freshness to it.
I'll just make sure to read the directions next time.
Thank you.
What's your go-to meal when you come home late and harried and maybe you have great ingredients in your cupboard, but maybe you don't?
Well, if it's late and I'm harried, chances are I don't have great ingredients. I mean, I strongly believe that you have to have a well-stocked pantry and you have to have some stuff in your refrigerator. But if you get home late and harried, chances are you haven't had time to shop for the freshest stuff that you might have. So I do a lot of pasta. I do a lot of eggs. There's a great recipe in here for scrambled eggs with broccoli that's become a staple for a lot of people. It's just kind of got that right comfort foodie feeling and takes 15 minutes. I mean, it's really good. But, you know, I do, like many people, I do a lot of pasta when it's late at night.
But the key is to not be afraid. Even I can do this.
That is the key. And to read the instructions.
Mark Bittman, he writes about food for the New York Times. He is the author of the new book, How to Cook Everything Fast. Thanks so much for talking with us, Mark.